my first gathering in Hamilton. Just been in Christchurch and Wellington. My name is Dave Amrita Swami, and I'm based in New Zealand, but I travel all over the world. So, what do I do? Why do I travel so much? To meet people, to find special people, and to discuss topics that are most important for our happiness and fulfillment in life. So by meeting with people like you, I get to see what are the problems, what are the victories, what are the defeats. I get to see what's bugging people, and I also get to see what's enlivening people. These days, it's quite interesting whether I'm in the developed world or the developing world. Everywhere I see, there's one common problem: stress. Everyone's stressed out these days. You know how it's the information age, but everyone's on information overload. People have to work longer hours. They're in anxiety about what the future will be, what the economy will be. Life isn't so simple anymore, even in a place like India or South America. Life's becoming very complex because everywhere you find satellite television bringing in the desires that you're supposed to have. So even in a village in India, people are becoming very stressed because they feel they don't have the consumer products that are supposedly necessary for you to be happy. Hamilton is a much more slow pace than Wellington or parts of Auckland. Christchurch can be pretty slow. I like cities this size because you don't have to spend all day driving around to get what you want. And that makes me think about life and how it's lived. What are we spending all our life trying to get? We can understand the subject of stress on three different levels, which I'll discuss with you tonight. Now, it's very interesting that only just recently have scientists accepted as fact the relationship between mental stress and physical health. You might be very surprised about that, but that is true. The notion has always been there amongst people, but it hasn't been scientifically accepted until recently. That your mental state has direct implications for your health. Now it is scientifically recognized, if that's how you base your knowledge in life, it is scientifically recognized that when people are in anxiety, their health suffers. There are hormones in the body, chemicals in the body that are released in order to get your body to cope with stress. The scientific explanation is that the human being is meant for occasional stress, but not day after day after day. perhaps you could think what life was like a couple of hundred years ago. Maybe there was a stressful event every once in a while. There was an attack on your village or town, or somebody got very sick and there was no doctor around. Those kind of stresses came periodically. Now you have day after day after day of stress. So medical scientists are saying that the human body is actually not meant for this. Because what happens when there is stress, when there's anxiety, is that the body goes into a special gear, like a car, goes into overdrive. But it's not supposed to stay in overdrive. Day after day after day. One example given by medical scientists is salmon. You have salmon in New Zealand? Yes, so you know. They swim upstream against the current when it's time for them to reproduce, to lay eggs. Now, what gets them upstream, fighting against the current? There's a hormone called cortisol that's released in the salmon, which causes them to have that mighty power and drive to get upstream against the current. And their whole physical system just goes into overtime. By the time that they get upstream, they're completely worn out. Their digestive system has shrunken because of the adrenaline rush, the adrenaline drive. They forget about eating, and in fact their digestive system practically withers away. They work themselves to a tizzy in this special overtime effort. By the time they get upstream and lay their eggs, they die. Because they're just worn out completely. So medical scientists say human beings have the same tendency. They do have the capacity to work very hard in terms of dealing with stress, but not day after day or week after week or year after year. Stresses come in many ways. It's not simply that people who have a demanding job suffer from stress. Stress can come from relationship problems. Stress can come from family problems. Stress can come from worrying about the economy or world events or so many things. Recently I was speaking at RMIT in Melbourne, Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, which is considered to be the premier scientific or technical university in Australia. And I was speaking about this topic of stress, so I expected, you know, maybe 10 or 15 students would come. When the time came for me to give the talk, I was shocked. The auditorium was packed with 250 students, all concerned about stress. And then recently I was reading in the New Zealand newspapers that stress will be a booming industry in New Zealand, because now if you have an employer who can be shown to have put the employee into stressful working circumstances, then the employer is liable. So, the business persons were predicting this is going to be a big industry. People accusing their employers of stressing them out. The employers have to be responsible that their workers are not in what can be seen to be an overly stressful situation. students are stressed out because will they get a job when they finish university? I know one person. He just finished the top of his class in accounting at Canterbury. And he applied for an accounting job at Price Waterhouse, you know, prestigious international accounting firm. There were 20 positions, and the people at Price Waterhouse told him, we've got 800 applicants, out of which 400 are all qualified. So this kind of thing produces stress, even in young persons who haven't broken into the working world yet. And then what about those who are working? They're also subject to so much stress now because they don't know what will the future bring. They have a job now, but there's no guarantee the job will be tomorrow. I know another person. She worked as a flight attendant for Ansett Australia for 20 years. And she was due to retire and get her pension in 1 week. And 1 week before she was due to retire, Ansett Australia went under. That meant. And she lost her seniority also. Now she's working for some newly formed division of Qantas called Australian Airlines, but she's got no seniority. She lost 20 years of seniority. She lost her pension. So naturally you can imagine, suppose that was you, 1 week short after 20 years. This is reality. These are real. This is what's going on. I was talking to an executive in a ceramics factory, not like artistic ceramics, but industrial ceramics, and he had to lay off middle managers, tell them that, sorry, but the business is not doing well enough. We can't maintain so many middle managers. And he told me they would always wait till Friday morning to give the bad news, because they figured if they say it like on Monday or Tuesday, the rest of the plant has time to really fester over, well, how come that, you know, wow, they laid him off, maybe we should do something about it. So they wait till Friday morning on purpose so that, you know, people will get drunk over the weekend and party or whatever and forget about it to a certain degree, and then when they come back to work on Monday, won't be so intense an issue. And he was telling me that he had to give the bad news to these middle managers, men who had given 20 years of their life to the company. He said most of them would just break down and cry. They're so shattered. 20 years. Some of them would overdo their job, come in at 7:30 in the morning, leave 8 o'clock at night, forget about their families. They were just doing everything they could to be seen as a prize employee, as a prize manager. And then you don't get any advance warning, because this executive is explaining, we don't want to give advance warnings about terminating people or laying them off, because everything is computerized these days. They can get into the computer system and cause big havoc. So we just tell them, I'm sorry, we can't maintain you anymore. Can you kind of be out of here in 20 minutes? You can't do that? Well, just do what you can and leave anything that you can't finish in 20 minutes. Or maybe we'll send somebody to help you. Because they're so afraid. Everything's on computer. some middle manager can just get want revenge and just get on the computer system and just cause havoc. So they wait till Friday morning and just call you in on the spot and say, that's it, after 20 years. So these men, these middle managers, they would just break down and cry like babies. Like, how am I going to face my family? And you know, they just come to work for Friday morning and now they have to drive back home and wait for their kids to come back from school. Maybe their wife's working or something, and wait for her to come back and find the man at home. He's got to explain it all. He said some of them couldn't even drive themselves home. The company had to get someone to drive them because they were just so distraught they couldn't even drive their car back. So this is quite common now. Then you have stress for teenagers. They have to have certain things because all the other teenagers are doing like that. I've spoken to so many teenage boys and girls in New Zealand who really get devastated when their girlfriend or their boyfriend leaves them. You know, like, how am I going to go to school the next day? Everyone will know. One 16-year-old boy was telling me, she left me because she said I was boring. How will I face my mates tomorrow? He was in complete anxiety. And girls, they're under so much pressure. I was hearing from one girl how she didn't want to kind of knuckle under to peer pressure to be flexible in a certain way. So the boys didn't like that. So what the boys did was they told all the girls in school, so-and-so thinks she's really special. I mean, she's not cooperating with our program. And so the guys got the girls to get on her case. And really, you know, and she just felt real, it felt really cruel to her. And the girls were needling her. Hey, you know, what's wrong? You're weird or something, you know? And she was under such pressure. She was so stressed out. She was practically pulling her hair. So stress is an extraordinary part of life today. Now, I like to analyze the problem of stress on three levels. One I'll do very quickly because it's what everyone's familiar with in terms of stress management. They're familiar with things like, okay, take a few deep breaths, or go out walking in nature, go out for a tramp, or just slow down. This is what most people understand as stress management. I would like to say that that approach is very superficial. The real problem is our lifestyle. If we're going to get rid of, or at least minimize, stress and anxiety, we have to change our lifestyle. Now, how much of a change should it be? Is it that we should move from the city into the country? Or is it that we should work part-time instead of full-time? I would say that those kind of alterations are surface. They're superficial. If you want to make a substantial change in your lifestyle, I would say you have to cope with the question of what you are. Are you the body? Are you matter? Or are you something else? Upon this question, the ancient spiritual classic of India, Bhagavad Gita, is based. First, understand what you are. Understand what composes you. And then you can make a decision about lifestyle. But if you try to fashion your lifestyle without understanding what you are, it'll be a very frustrating experience. You may even practice deep breathing. You may even take a half hour of silence. Still, if you haven't come to grips with what is the self, then there'll always be stress. I was at the swimming pool in Wellington and had a very interesting experience. There was one man about his late 20s there, and he was kind of boasting to the older men in the sauna. He was saying, "My lifestyle is so wonderful. I found very few people who have such a good lifestyle as me. I mean, really, I mean, my lifestyle is enviable. I do yoga. I do meditation. Money's not a priority for me. You know, I live outside of the city. What am I doing in the city today?" Well, you know, they have this International Sevens competition, and I just wanted to come and see what the people are into, you know. I just wanted to see all the fools who are going to the stadium, you know. I wanted to see what, you know, what they were into. I mean, you know, I can't believe it. 95% of the population is into this stuff. I just wanted to see it, you know. And he went on bragging about his lifestyle. I mean, I do yoga. I do meditation. I mean, I found very few people who have such a lifestyle like me. And the kind of the older guys in the sauna were, yeah, sounds good. Yeah. And he just went on and on like that. And yeah, I went to the first day of the Sevens matches, and I just couldn't believe it. Overload of sensory inputs. Oh, this is too much. I can't believe people can just live like this. I didn't know whether to watch the guys on the field or watch the match on the big screen. You know. And then there was people behind me getting drunk, and there was this and that. And, oh, just hellish. I just can't believe how stressed people are. So one guy asked him, "Hey, mate, by the way, how much did you pay for the, you know, your ticket?" "Ah, 2-day event, you know, $90. I just wanted to see the stressed out people." And then he said, "And after the second day at night, I'm going to go check out a few pubs in Wellington just to see the stupid people." I mean, I know they're really going to be getting drunk, and I just want to see, you know? I mean, I just can't believe how people are these days. Everyone was just kind of nodding their head. I just kind of looked at them like, "Are you being for real?" Obviously, you're bored, and you drove into the city, you know, to look for some excitement at the Sevens. And yeah, you know, it goes from like 3 p.m. to late at night. You know, they have music and not simply the matches, but they have all sorts of things going on. And afterwards you go into the pub, you know, and it's all just to see the crazy, stressed out people, right? So my point in telling this little story is that we've got to get a little deeper in our life if we're going to really adjust our lifestyle and make it favorable. I'll tell you another story from the ancient literature of India called Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita. There was a 5-year-old boy, and his father was an emperor, a very dastardly emperor, a much more powerful version of, you might say, a Saddam Hussein. And his father had no scruples about power, holding on to power, expanding power. And the father was hoping his boy would be like him. So he was having his son trained up in power politics and terror tactics from a young age. He was hoping his son would start learning this at 5 years old. He was sending his son to a special school for future dictators. So, one day he lovingly embraced his son, as fathers are apt to do, put his son on his lap, and he asked his son, "My dear boy, what is the best thing that you've learned in school?" In Sanskrit, the boy's name was Prahlad, and his father's Sanskrit name was Hiranyakashipu. The father was very proud of his name because in Sanskrit, Haranya means gold and Kashipu means soft bedding. So his father was proud of his name that indicated his predilections for the pleasures of gold and soft bedding and the activities thereof. So he asked his son, "My dear boy, tell me, what's the best thing you've learned in school today?" He didn't expect anything that profound from a 5-year-old boy. But he was shocked at the answer that his son gave. His son said, "My dear father, best of the demoniac rulers, anyone who identifies the self as the body must always be in anxiety. Because such a person has accepted wrongly the body and mind as the self. And because of that wrong acceptance, because of that misidentification of the body and mind as the self, they have to suffer. They have to be in anxiety. They have to be stressed out. Because they've accepted themselves as something which they are not." When the father, Hiranyakashipu, heard this, he was just enraged, like, "Where did you get this nonsense kind of knowledge from?" Then he thought, it's just a 5-year-old boy. Who knows, he might have picked this up from some stray person. His father was upset because if his son, the next in line for the throne, is thinking that he's not the body, he's not the mind, he's something else, what kind of materialist can his son be? He won't have much of a future as a materialist if he understands his non-material identity. So the 5-year-old boy said like that, "Anyone who mistakenly takes the body and mind as the self must be in anxiety. That's the best thing I've learned in school today." So the father said, "Wait a minute. I don't have any teachers employed at that school who teach this kind of stuff. Where did you learn it?" So the father immediately summoned for the teachers. "What is my boy doing speaking this, you know, non-materialist stuff? Where did he get it from?" And the teachers were trembling. "Oh, Your Honor, Your Majesty, we didn't tell him this. We have no idea where he got it from. He must have been listening to some Krishna-conscious persons, Krishna-conscious teachers who snuck in the school in disguise. Otherwise, there's no way we can understand how he's spouting such talk about how we are spirit soul, we're not the body, and we don't teach these things. We've taught him again and again, there's nothing beyond matter, and therefore, just enjoy any way you can. Don't worry about any reactions, any karmic reactions to your activities. There's no such thing. Do what you gotta do to get power and maintain power. Do what you have to do to enjoy. Everything just depends on how you see things. There's no one else watching. You will not be held accountable. Make merry while you can. Live life to the fullest. Don't worry. After death, everything will be finished. That's what we've been teaching it. Don't have any qualms. Don't have any scruples. Everything is just matter. And so it really doesn't matter that any pain you cause someone else in order to please yourself, because in the end it just counts. Did you get all you can get for yourself? This is what we've been teaching him, that there's nothing spiritual to life. Some scientists, they say like that these days. They try to teach you that consciousness is a material phenomenon. There's no proof whatsoever for that. No scientist in the world can prove to you that consciousness is material. They can simply say like that. Oh, consciousness is something that arises from the brain cells. They can say like that, no proof. So the teachers of this boy, they were quite frightened. Oh, how did this boy learn these things? This is a great scandal. This story is from time immemorial in ancient India. But I was hearing something like that even recently. I have a cohort, he's Russian, and during the end of the communist days in Russia, he was going to university in Tashkent, and there were 10,000 students in the university. And somehow or other, the faculty found out that there was one boy out of 10,000 who was saying he believed in God. And the whole university staff got up in arms. They made the boy's life so hellish that he had to withdraw. The whole university staff got into it. There's one student out of 10,000 who has espoused belief in a supreme being. This is a blemish against our whole academic establishment. They took it in that way. So they just made this one student's life so miserable. My cohort who told me the story, he says, he knows all about it because when the student was finally forced out, humiliated and beat down so much by peer pressure and popular opinion, he finally just left university as it was intended. He had a New Testament, so he gave it to my cohort. So my cohort, he read the New Testament. And then he went on from there to Bhagavad Gita, which he's absorbed in now. So we can see that some people are very intent that you don't understand anything more than the material concept of life. But that material concept of life produces so much stress and strain because we are not trying to satisfy our spiritual self, we're forced to compete with others to satisfy the false material identity. Therefore, there's always a shortage of resources because you can't satisfy a material identity. You'll always try for more and more and more and more. However, if people learn the arts of spiritual satisfaction, that will automatically cause less scarcity in the world because people won't misappropriate resources to try to satisfy the material self, which they're not. A spiritually satisfied person can live simply. A spiritually satisfied person understands that matter cannot satisfy me. So why should I fight over matter? Why should I cause so many complications individually, nationally, internationally, just because of matter? It cannot satisfy anyone. Once people can have an actual understanding of their spiritual identity, then you'll see a big change in the world. Otherwise, not. As long as people think, I am this body, and matter satisfies this body, there'll be fighting, there'll be strife, competition. But if you distribute knowledge that people are spirit soul, this is what Bhagavad Gita is doing, then people will be self-satisfied and they won't be prone to causing so many disturbances in their quest for material satisfaction, which is never fulfilled. Of course, you know the famous statement by Karl Marx that religion is the opiate of the people. Yeah. Quite outdated statement, because these days the people prefer real opiates. They don't need religion, they just take the straight stuff. I spent 10 years teaching Krishna consciousness underground in communist Europe, so I know about these notions. I also made a few trips to communist China back in the 80s. It's much easier now, but back in the 80s, it was pretty tough. So, we have to find out what is the self and what actually satisfies the self, rather than just say, such and such is the opiate of the people, religion is a way to artificially satisfy everyone. Let's be open-minded. What is real religion? Real religion means first understand what you are. Are you this body or are you something else? Then, the next step, because you can't stop there, that's just the beginning. The next step is to understand, okay, if I'm not the body, if I'm a spiritual entity, what is the larger spiritual reality that I'm part of? And what is my relationship with that larger spiritual reality? We have to see, are we matter or are we not? This is the most important question to begin your life, to base your lifestyle on. Am I matter or am I something different? Am I this body? Am I this mind, or am I something beyond it all? Sometimes people say, well, maybe we're all three. We're body, mind, and spirit. Well, you have to explain that. Suppose I say, well, I'm the clothes, I'm the skin, and I'm the spirit. Doesn't sound like it makes much sense to you, does it? You say, hey, you're just wearing the clothes. You can take the clothes off, and you're still existing. Well, Bhagavad Gita teaches that you can take the body off and you'll still be existing. You can take the mind off and you'll still be existing. And what is that thing that will still be existing? In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that that is the spirit soul, which goes from body to body, life to life. Once we can understand that the spirit soul changes bodies, then we can understand that there's more than just one life. Just like there's more than just one set of clothes for me. I can change the set of clothes. Similarly, we can change the set of body we have. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that according to your consciousness at the time of death, that attracts the next body for you. You get a custom fit, tailored body according to your state of mind at the time of death. And it won't necessarily be a human body. It depends on your mentality, your consciousness, your desires at the time of death. The time of death is like the key moment. Maybe you've heard from someone who's almost died. Maybe they almost drowned or they were almost finished in a car accident. You'll often hear that they explain something called a life review. If you study near-death experiences, you'll find this is quite common. People can see their whole life flash before their eyes in a few seconds. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains, according to your consciousness at the time of death, what you're thinking about, that will bring the next body. So if you're thinking about your whole life, seeing that life review flash before your mind's eye in a few seconds, and if your life has been materialistic, then you'll get the suitable result in your next life. And if your life has been spiritualized, then you'll also get the suitable result in your next life. So all these things are explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Now, in terms of shaping our lifestyle so that we're free from anxiety, naturally, if we can conclusively understand what we are, am I matter? If I'm not matter, why should I try to satisfy myself materially? I would be a fool to waste my life trying to satisfy this piece of cloth. You would say, it's just covering you, it's not you. Don't waste your time. But it is the same thing with the body. It's also the same thing with the mind. Everyone can see the body, the physical body, but very few people can see the subtle body. You have some people who can see auras, they can see your astral body. That means they're seeing your mind. They're seeing the mind and its effects. Most people can't, though. It's like most people can't see the wind. They just see the effects of the wind. So you have a gross body of gross matter. You have a subtle body, meaning it's of subtle matter. This is explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Neither of these coverings, gross or subtle, are you. Now, once we understand conclusively, I am a spiritual entity, then you have to arrange your lifestyle in that way. And you'll notice the stress goes. Because you'll start to think, okay, I am a spiritual entity, how do I get spiritual satisfaction? You'll start to think like that. If I'm not matter, why should I do material activities in order to satisfy myself? I'll be stressed out. I'll be full of anxiety. Therefore, all over the world, I make this point that if you really want to get rid of stress and anxiety, you have to stop this deadly problem of misidentifying the self as matter. That's the beginning. And then naturally, any intelligent person will think, if I'm not matter, I'm spirit, okay, what am I a part of? If I say I'm matter, it's obviously I'm part of the total stock of matter in the universe. But if I'm spiritual, what is the spiritual reality that I am part of? What's my relationship with that ultimate spiritual reality? What are my duties in relation to that ultimate spiritual reality? So this is the middle level of stress management. We talked about the superficial approach to stress. Breathe deeply, go for a walk, get a part-time job, have a garden. But we have to go much deeper in our approach. Let's at least get to the middle approach, which is understanding that stress and anxiety come from misidentification of the body as a self. Then, finally, there's a deeper level. Stress indicates that we are misusing our human form of life. According to the ancient Vedic knowledge of India, stress is there as an indication from nature that you're misusing the potential of your human life. It's the notice that there's been a violation of the purpose of life. That is what stress is, at its deepest level. This human life is different from other creatures. The human life gives you the advanced consciousness by which you can understand what is the self, what is the supreme self. Just like there are individual conscious entities, the ancient Vedic knowledge also explains that there is a supreme conscious entity. The human form of life is for understanding both the individual conscious entities and the supreme conscious entity. That's why human beings have the full consciousness, which an animal or a tree or a bird doesn't. Those creatures have some consciousness, but compared to humans, it's limited. The human being has the full consciousness for discussing subject matter like we've been doing tonight. But if the human being wastes his or her life on simply trying to satisfy the body, living in a material concept of life, that is a great disaster. And therefore, the laws of nature reciprocate by filling your mind with stress. In other words, you're getting a reaction for a misuse of wealth. The wealth is your human body. How should you spend it? Spend that developed consciousness, that full consciousness, on understanding the ultimate questions. I remember there was one 16-year-old girl, and she would always ask her high school. You'll grow out of it. She was like asking, like, who am I? Why are we in this world? What is the nature of the self? So her high school teacher just told her, you're a teenager. That's why you're thinking about these things. When you grow up, you become mature. Then. This human form of life gives us a tremendous responsibility. There are activities that the human being shares with the animals. Eating, sleeping, reproducing, and defense. If human beings simply absorb themselves in these things, then, as you can see, they're not much different than animals. Many people these days will say that proudly. Yeah, there's no difference. But there should be a difference. The advanced consciousness of the human being is not simply meant for bodily affairs of eating, sleeping, reproduction, and defense. The advanced consciousness of the human being is meant for dealing with the ultimate questions of life. When your lifestyle is lived in that way, then there's less stress because you're using your human life for what nature intended it for. So this is part of what I explained at RMIT, Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. I also explained the same thing last month at the top scientific university in India. They have five branches in the five major cities of India. It's called India Institute of Technology. The system was established by Nehru right after India's independence. His idea was that India was backwards because of lack of technological advancement that so characterized the West. So he figured he would jumpstart the Indian rise to technological happiness by creating these scientific campuses, which would be outside the main cities. The students would be secluded, and they would develop their scientific research capacities and lead India into the golden age of technology. So that was Nehru's doing. To get into these universities, the students have to start preparing when they're 5 years old. They're not tested on having a well-rounded education. They're tested on being able to quickly respond to a very limited range of logic-type questions. The kind of logic that computer programming is based on. So, they're considered to be the cream of the crop. And Nehru's plan was that they would be the army that would bring India its glory. Things didn't work out that way. What happens to those students? They don't stay in India. 80% of them go to the USA. Even before they graduate, their first year at the university, the American corporations come and recruit them all because they know they make the best computer programmers. So much for Nehru's plan. They all go overseas. 80% of them go overseas. I told them, why do you call it IIT, India Institute of Technology? You better call it AIT, American Institute of Technology. But then one professor there told me, well, it's not a complete defeat for Nehru because these students, they'll get high-paying jobs in the USA and they'll send back hard currency. And that way the country will benefit. So, needless to say, these students are all very stressed out because they have to compete so much. How to be on top. And also, they're seeing coming into India all the pushings, all the artificial motivations that have been in the West for decades, because the multinational corporations see India and China as the last marketing frontier. They're not overloaded yet with, you know, dryers and washing machines and hair dryers and electric this, electric that. And, you know, there's like a billion people in India. Great market, untapped. So, therefore, the advertising in India this has gone from nothing to saturating the environment. And people are not used to it, so they're just, I mean, you're used to advertising. You know, it has to be very subliminal to affect you all because you've seen it for years. In fact, I noticed now in New Zealand a new trend in advertising is to just make something totally apparently disconnected. And so you're driving on the street and you see, I'll give you an example, something I saw in Wellington. They had a picture of a kind of a plain looking girl, and then the headline said, Jenny Johnson's new see-through outfit. And so, naturally the average man would, oh, yeah. But, you know, she was just a plain girl, fully dressed. And then next to her was a Mazda. Yeah? So, you finally would look at the Mazda, and, you know, and you remember it. That's the point of that kind of advertising, because people are so overstimulated that they have to do things like that. But in India, it's not like that. It's all new for the people, and their heads are just swimming in it. So, the students are very stressed out. Therefore, I say all over the world, I'm seeing the same problems. Global culture is producing a global sameness in problems. If we want to make a difference, we have to start to make a difference with ourselves. What is myself? Am I matter? Am I a chunk of matter? Am I something else? Am I non-material? And if I'm non-material, what is the overall spiritual reality that I'm part of? What is my relationship with that overall spirituality? This is what the ancient Vedic knowledge calls Krishna consciousness. Knowledge of the individual consciousness and knowledge of the Supreme Consciousness and the relationship between the two. When our human form of life is used to explore these areas, then nature rewards us by turning down the stress. We won't be in such anxiety because we are actually living naturally. So maybe you have some questions or anything you'd like to discuss. Yes. Now, an easy approach to understanding the non-material identity is to deal with consciousness. There's not a single scientific apparatus in this world which can directly detect consciousness. That should let you know that there's something about the self which is not materially perceptible. What Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita is that you cannot detect the spirit self with material senses. If you're going to be able to perceive the spiritual reality, you have to train your senses to act another way. You could say that you have to spiritualize your senses so that they can detect the spiritual reality. Now, this is not such a far-fetched notion. One professor of physics from Harvard University was telling me that it takes on the average 8 years to train a student of quantum physics to be able to see the world through the strange, mind-boggling view that makes up quantum mechanics. 8 years. Because they have to learn to not see the way they're accustomed to see and see everything completely differently. So it takes an average 8 years. So that's something material, yet it takes such qualifications, such training. Or we can give a more ordinary example. If you look through a microscope at some biological material, unless you're trained, you won't recognize what you're seeing in the microscope. Your eyes have to be trained to recognize what you see. So similarly, if we're going to understand what is spirit, we have to undergo some training. We have to undergo some purification. If there's mud on the windscreen, you cannot see. You have to clean the mud off the windscreen, then you can see. So the glory of the knowledge of ancient India that we're presenting in a modern context called Krishna consciousness is that without purifying the senses, there's no question of accessing the spiritual reality. And the main thing that's blocking our perception of the spiritual reality is thinking I'm this body, misidentifying the self. That's the main impurity. It's the main hunk of mud on the windscreen. Then there are spiritual techniques we can take up, which directly connect with the ultimate spiritual reality. So there are two things simultaneously: purification and taking up of spiritual methods to connect with the spiritual reality. Krishna consciousness is based on mantra meditation, non-material sound to connect with non-material reality. But as long as we think, I am this body, naturally we're going to do things to satisfy the body. And in that way we pollute our consciousness by living in a hallucination. First thing we have to do is clean ourselves up from this bodily conception of life. Then we adopt spiritual techniques, positive spiritual techniques for accessing the spiritual reality. This is what Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita. So we can't just live in negation. I'm not the body. I'm not matter. What are you? What are you about? What's your positive lifestyle? But it has to be an adoption of spiritual techniques for accessing the ultimate spiritual reality. So that's a good question. Focus on the negative and focus on the positive. The negative is, I got to free my life from what I am not. I got to free my life from inauthenticity. We were discussing this in Wellington last week, and people were revealing, they were very upset that they felt there was so much inauthenticity in their life. They were forced, they felt, to act in ways that were ingenuine. You know, I'm not really into this, I'm not really like this, but I have to act in this way because society expects it from me, or some person expects it from me, or the boss expects it from me, or my partner expects it from me, but I really, in my heart, don't feel this way, or don't want to do these things. That's one kind of inauthenticity of the self. But the major kind is thinking I'm something that I'm not, and then forcing myself to act in that illusory way. So we have to deal with that negative. And then there has to be a focus on the positive. If I am spirit soul, what is my relationship with the ultimate spiritual reality? How do I get real pleasure from the ultimate spiritual reality instead of scratching to get pleasure from the illusory material reality? How is it that I get real pleasure? I think many of you have seen that film, The Matrix, yes? Yeah. So remember when the guy defected from that little crew of illusion fighters, he defected back into The Matrix, and he was telling the agents, I know when I sink my teeth into a steak, I know it's all a computer program generated by The Matrix, but I just want it anyway. I know it's all an illusion, but I just want it. I want to be an actor. Make me famous. And the agents were looking at him. Yeah, we're able to arrange all that. I know it's all unreal. It's all just a computer-generated, simulated reality. But I want it. I gotta have it. Remember at the beginning of the film where the guy, I think it was Morpheus, when he got the recruit, he said, okay, here's the red pill. Here's the blue pill. You take one pill, you forget everything that there could be an escape out of this, and you just go back to where you came from like nothing ever happened. You take the other pill, you're with us. So everybody faces that choice. You want the red pill, or you want the blue pill? You know what most people take. The problem with that film, by the way, is that they didn't present you with any positive alternative. They very graphically presented what is, you know, illusion, but okay, if you give that up, what do? Just fly around in that, you know, little tin aircraft, you know? That's why the guy, you know, defected. He said, I'm not going to spend my whole life flying around in that thing, you know? I want some action, even if it's illusion. I want action. They would make vague references to this city within the earth where everything was wonderful. But the point is, unless people get awareness of the higher taste, they won't be able to give up the lower taste. Krishna speaks about that in Bhagavad Gita. He said, you may even try to control your senses, discipline yourself, but you'll fail unless you get a superior standard of pleasure. Upon getting a superior standard of pleasure, Krishna says you'll automatically give up the lower pleasure out of self-interest. Anything?
You're saying it's about life, it's about like going towards like becoming aware. Wouldn't we already be aware like of the consciousness in that? Because I came across a philosophy of like life is about experiences, and so to experience the hatred of the world, to experience the materialism is really just valid as like trying to break through consciousness, like if you're trying to educate the consciousness in what it's like to have the material boundaries, what it's like to live and die. Yeah. So it's actually a quite valid experience.
What's a quite valid experience?
Just to live.
Well, that the animals are doing.
Yeah.
If you ever watch sheep?
Yeah.
They're just living, aren't they?
But do they hate? Do they know what it is to hate and jealous and to be greedy? I mean,
they know what good food is. I've seen in New Zealand that some farmers, they have like a, you know, they have thousands of sheep over thousands of acres, and, that those sheep are just eating any, going up the mountains and into the, gullies and eating brown grass and twigs. But then they got other little lambs that are on a special section surrounded by a fence. And they're not eating just anything. They have like salad greens all planted in a row. Yes, you've seen that? And they are so happy. Their coats are shining because of such a wonderful diet. Their wool is shining in the light. You can practically see these lambs smiling as like, this is it, this is heaven. I mean, these other sheep, they're out there, scrounging around the brown grass and remnants of shrubs, and here we are, we've got it all laid out, row after row. Sometimes I see them, most of the time they're just nibbling and eating, but sometimes they just lay down in between the rows of greens, just like stones, just zonked out, like, wow. You can actually see a smile on their face, like, oh, this is just it. But what's their future? Why do they get that special treatment? Yeah, they're the special lambs that are going to be someone's, Yeah. And every day the farmer comes out, farmers have told me, every day they go out and they weigh those lambs because those lambs are getting their best food, so they want to make sure that lamb is really fattening up right. They're counting their profits already, Put another few kilos on this lamb and I'll be more money in my bank account. The lambs don't understand. They're just living. They're having a good time, but they don't know what's coming. Well, let's put it. Yes, it's challenging, but as Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, if you get the higher spiritual taste, it's easy to let go of the material taste. But if you don't get something higher, it's hard to give up these lower things. Let us say, for example, you were driving a 1970 Morris Minor. And that's what you used to get around Hamilton. And I just ridiculed you. Ah, what are you driving such a junky car for? Come on, this is 2003. That car's 33 years old. It's, it's just beat up. It's just a sewing machine engine. Let's just give it up. Give it up. Everybody knows it's, it's way outdated. How would you feel? No, it was just your only car. Yeah. Well, you wouldn't like it because you would say, well, look, this is all I have, Even if I don't like it, still, this is all I have. I'm not going to just toss it away. But suppose I kept saying that. throw that car out. Just throw it out. It's just nothing. Well, you know, I got to have something, you know. You might either be proudly attached to it, or you might just say, look, this is the best I can do. I don't know anything else. So you wouldn't be so keen to give it up and just, you know, walk around and have nothing. But instead, suppose I said, guess what? I have this brand new Mercedes for you. I'll give you the brand new Mercedes if you will kindly throw out the Morris Minor. Would it be a big decision for you? Not at all. Hey, anytime. Because you see, from your self-interest, you're going to get something better. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. You have to find techniques of spiritual lifestyle. Otherwise, it'll all be theoretical. You have to find spiritual techniques of living. Otherwise, everything will be theoretical. You've met so many people, I'm sure, who say, yeah, I know, it's all spiritual. You know, it's just kind of like, you know, it's like, just be with the energy, you know. I mean, you know, it's just, everything is spiritual in its own way, and, you know. It's good cafe talk, isn't it? You know, every guy's got a spiritual girlfriend, and even rugby players, they say, well, when I went in, when I scored that try, it was such a spiritual feeling. Everybody uses the word these days, you know? So, unless we find some actual spiritual techniques for getting spiritual pleasure, we're not going to give up the material illusion. No matter how much we talk about it, the consumerists, pressures, the emptiness, the multinationals, the this, the that, you know, the popular culture, the commercial culture, on and on we can go, ranting and raving. We won't give it up. I remember, who's that, a favorite example of mine from New Zealand, that he was, I think up until recently he was, he may still be, the mayor of Invercargill. What's his name? What's that? He's quite a famous character. Oh. Anyway, wasn't he? He used to be a student radical, in the, what, didn't he? Yeah. So I remember, I heard it from him. He told me. I've met quite a few New Zealand leaders, including what's the, one of your prime ministers, David Lomi. I've met him. I've talked to him. So, by the way, I'm a refugee from New York, guys. I'm a New Zealand citizen, but I wasn't born here. So, this person in Invercargill, this mayor, he told me, you know, I was a student radical. My wife and I, we were just completely into, you know, against the system. We were just going to do everything, you know, non-material. We, you know, we even, you know, we bought a farm outside the city, and we just were growing our own veggies and wearing no clothes, and no. You know, the whole family wore no clothes, and we were just totally non-material. And he told me, one day I just kind of looked at my partner, and, you know, and we just looked at each other and said, what the heck are we doing here? It's cold out here with no clothes, and we don't even have a PowerPoint in the house to, you know, to play in a stereo. We didn't have a stereo to play any music. And they just looked at each other, and both of them realized, what are we doing? This is nuts. So they just, you know, put their clothes on and drove to the nearest city, you know, and kind of merged back into society. I mean, that's the way he explains it himself. So unless you actually have some spiritual techniques, spiritual lifestyle, we'll talk so many things, but everything will be the same as everybody else. So therefore, our quest in life is really for spiritual techniques, spiritual lifestyle. How to change our actions, how to perform different types of actions. Bhagavad Gita teaches how to perform non-reactive work in a world of reactions. You may, if you study the Bible, which I did when I was a kid. You remember Jesus instructed, you should be in the world, but not of the world. Now, that's a very deep statement, and it requires a profound technology of life to live like that. Very few people know how to do that, how to be in the world, but not of the world. The technique is elaborately explained in Bhagavad Gita, where Lord Krishna teaches how to perform work that has no karmic reaction, even though you're living in a world of karma. So these are the kinds of techniques, engineering techniques we need to apply in our life. Otherwise, everything, every action has a reaction. Unless you learn the art of performing non-reactive work, work that has no karmic reaction. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes non-reactive work as actions performed for the pleasure of the Supreme. That is what Krishna consciousness is. Be conscious of the ultimate reality, Krishna. Perform your activities for the pleasure of the ultimate reality, and then there's no karma. But as soon as you perform activities for your own benefit, then there must be karma. Even you're saying, like, for example, the ancient Vedic knowledge of India explains, if I see you're hungry, I give you food. There'll be a karmic reaction. It'll be a good reaction, but it'll still be a karmic reaction. In my next birth, I'll have to appear so that you can return the favor to me in some way. Everything has to balance out. I gave you, so I have to take birth again so you can give me. Now, obviously, it's much better karma to give someone something than to steal something. But still, we don't want any karmic reaction. The intelligent person doesn't want any karmic reaction. It's like you don't want to be bound by any handcuffs, whether the handcuffs are made of tin or gold. Anyone ever had the uncomfortable experience of being handcuffed? I did once. My father, he was an administrator in the New York City Police Department. So I was 5 years old and he was playing around with me. So one day he took out his handcuffs because, you know, in the States, no matter what rank you are in the police department, you have to carry cuffs, you got to carry your gun even off duty. So he was just playing around with me and he handcuffed, you know, he put one cuff around one wrist and he put the other around the doorknob. Yeah, just playing around with me, you know. So I just thought it was all fun too. And then all of a sudden, my father realized he didn't know where the key was to his cuffs. Oh, and he was like devastated. I'll never forget that. Like, oh no, what have I done? I'm psychologically damaging my son. I've got him cuffed to the doorknob like a criminal. I can't find the key. He had to get on the phone and call his workmates and, you know, in a complete embarrassment, tell them, hey, I handcuffed my son to the door, and I tend to send a patrol car by with a key so I can unlock my son. So I remember what it was like to be cuffed. It didn't matter whether the cuffs were made of tin or aluminum, or they could be made of gold encrusted with diamonds. I didn't want to be cuffed. So the message of Bhagavad Gita that Krishna is giving is, you don't want bad karma, you don't want good karma. You want to be free of all kinds of reactions. That involves appropriate lifestyle techniques. Anything else before? Yes?
You tell me your background, please.
Okay. Well, I already told you how I got to New Zealand. I'm a refugee from New York City. I was, I guess you would say, had a scholarly youth, and the university system in the States is quite different from what you have here. The university system in the States is kind of like England. You have your ordinary universities, and then you have your super high echelon schools, like the equivalent of Oxford, Cambridge. In the States, you have Harvard, Yale. So It's not like that in New Zealand. In the States, you are ranked according to the university you go to. So if you go to certain universities, like Yale, that's where all the presidents go and all the CEOs go. Both Bushes came from Yale. So, yes, that did. That's right. So, my family wasn't wealthy, but I guess you might say from the material point of view, the good thing about the educational system in the States is that at those super posh schools, finances are separate from academic qualifications. So, like at Harvard and Yale, if you academically qualify, they say it doesn't matter how wealthy you are, they'll pay. If they accept you academically, you have to go, no matter how what your economic status is. So, my mother was always pushing me as a youth. If you want to be successful in life, you got to do three things. You got to be a intellectual, you got to be a capitalist, and you got to be a Christian. So, yes, she was always pushing me like that. So I studied hard as a kid, and so she was very happy that I got a full scholarship, which these days Yale costs in New Zealand dollars $50,000 New Zealand dollars a year. That's but my mother didn't pay anything, so I went there for 4 years, and I was just looking for the highest knowledge. And at the end of my 4 years, here you go, you're 3 years for a bachelor's degree in the States, four. So at the end of my fourth year, I remember talking to my dean. You call them deans here too? Yeah. So I was telling him, I don't really see any position or hope for myself in this materialistic society. So, I was there kind of with my, standing in front of him, or sitting in front of him with my kind of long hair and my, purple pants and, it was back in the 70s, fringe vest and all these kind of things. And he just kind of looked at me. He said, didn't bat an eye, he just said, "You are a Yale man. You will influence the world." So maybe he was right, but not in the way he calculated. Anyway, right after I graduated, I came upon these books, Krishna conscious books like Bhagavad Gita and others that you see up there. And I started reading them 4 hours a day. But I didn't want anything to do with Krishna people. I thought they were weird. Oh, really? I'm just telling you the truth, you ass. I just thought they were kind of happy-go-lucky people who had great books. I said, these are the best books I've read in my life, and I've just had what's supposed to be like the finest education in the world, and I've never seen any books like these. But, as far as the people, I didn't want to have anything to do with them. I just thought they were kind of like in La La Land, or just, singing on the streets and all that kind of stuff. So I had to re-educate myself. And so I read the books for 4 hours a day, 6 months straight, before I'd even go to a gathering like you've come to tonight. You're much more open-minded than I was. But then I decided that this is how I wanted to live my life. This is how I wanted to influence the world. I figured, I was 22 at the time. I said, I've got to make a decision now. What's the best thing to do in life? Otherwise, I will become an old man with regrets. Because my father was pressuring me. Okay, you're graduating from Yale. He wants you, be an executive for IBM or General Motors or this or that or the other, And so I felt all this pressure on me. I said, I've got to figure out quick what I'm about, otherwise I could be washed away for, till I'm a senior citizen. So, that was about 30 years ago, and here I am today. Yes?
What was the maybe struggle with most?
struggle with most. The KGB, 10 years in communist Europe.
No, not so much that.
Those are real. It was a real personal struggle.
Like some of my mates and I transitioned, and then you're experiencing a lot of things. I know my friends, I totally love my friends.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my friends have lifestyle that are considered
unhealthy.
High structure.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
So I was wondering, you, what was the hard part of that sort of aspect of that?
Oh, no, not at all. Not everything is... No. I was not materially distressed when I took up Krishna consciousness. I pretty much had the best of what the world could offer. After I made the decision, what was the hardest thing, or before? After?
Before and after. It's nice before you make the decision.
Yeah. Before, I was engaged to be married, and so that was the hardest thing because my fiancé wasn't into spiritual things. So I had to deal with that. She would say, I'm just into complete materialism. She would tell me things like, I want to be a star. And I would say, hey, come on, you know, you're just going to fry yourself out, you know, get all overloaded with stress and then come to me to do something about it. I said, well, I don't know. Yeah. She was that kind of, you know, she was like a psychology major, an actress, and a dancer. That was all in one package there. So, that was the hardest thing, because, you know, bodily activities breed attachment. But I knew that I had to be honest. I had to be for real. And I didn't want to cheat her, so I just told her that. I said, you don't know who you are, I don't know who I am, so what good can I really do for you? No, not friends, not family. The hardest thing was her, because naturally someone you care for, you like the best for them. But she just was interested in being a materialist. She was crass about it. And so I had to accept that someone close to me had those kind of goals. So I said, well, look, I've got to be honest. I don't know who I am, you don't know who you are, and what can we really do for each other? I'll just be using you for sense gratification. I'll use you to gratify my senses, you'll use me to gratify your senses, and that's love? I can't accept it anymore. You know, I'm just using you to fill the time, you're using me to fill the time. We're both ignorant. We both have no idea where we were before, where we're going after death, what's the purpose of life. And yet we're supposed to be, you know, amongst the most educated people in the world. I said, I got a problem with that. I can't live like that. So.
So how do we understand?
Huh?
What was the next day? Wasn't very hard.
Well, yes, you know. It was difficult. I had to analyze my priorities and analyze my convictions and act according to my convictions. Now, the solace she had was I didn't leave her for another woman. To this day, there has not been anyone else. So I guess that's comforting for a lady that I that was it. But that was the hard. Now, since you're asking, yeah, that was the hardest thing. But maybe I was destined to be a monk. But we, you know, others, most who practice Krishna consciousness, they're married. This is Rasyatra. She and her husband run the cafe here. They came married, and they've been married, you know. I was just cut out maybe for something else. Just a different style, that's all. So that was the hardest thing before. But I must say, as time has gone by, I'm really relishing my freedom. Because, you know, you give that stuff up where it gives you up, right? you know, you can't, you know, do that stuff forever, right? You know, sort of later, you know, you can, you know, buy, you know, splurge on all the Viagra you want, but, you know, sooner or later the end of the line comes. So I figured, you know, I might as well give it up before he gives me up. And after, the hardest thing was, as I say, teaching Krishna consciousness behind the Iron Curtain. It was personally very difficult because I never could conceive of a system of organized suffering. Okay, we're used to incompetent governments, or maybe you have some criticisms about the New Zealand government or the American government. But I mean, I don't like that either. But but to see governments designed to put people in misery, that was just very, it was heart crushing. Because Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says that the real bliss is caring for others. That the neophyte is simply concerned with his own, her own spiritual advancement, but the devotee who is actually developing properly lives for the sake of others. So I was in my 20s when I made that decision to go behind the Iron Curtain, and it was quite some...
Yeah, you must have been blessed for sure.
That was, well, maybe we have a different definition of bliss, but selfless service for the sake of others' spiritual advancement, that was very blissful. Although it was also very harrowing too. These are spiritual emotions which are different from material emotions. It was very harrowing to see governments dedicated to stamping out any opportunity people had for spiritual development. Like a meeting like this, any moment the police could come storming in and take everybody's names, and if there was a foreigner like me there, oh, I'd really be in big trouble, and they'd be in big trouble too for listening to a foreigner, and their whole lives would be destroyed. To have to witness that kind of thing was very painful for the heart. But at the same time, the rewards of teaching people in those circumstances were exhilarating. They took it so seriously, much more under oppression than they are now. Than they're doing now. It's true that when there's times of distress, people inquire more deeply about life. When there's good times, they just want to let the good times roll. I've talked to many old New Zealanders in their 80s who were around during World War II, and their memories of New Zealand and what it was like is quite different from what I hear from a young person now. They would tell me, like, you know, one old lady was telling me, you know, how she got engaged to a guy in her high school, and immediately before they were married, the guy was on a boat, you know, to Europe to fight in the war. And she didn't see him for 5-6 years. And when he came back, you know, when he got off the boat, I forget where she said the boat landed. When he got off the boat, she fainted, you know, just that, you know, just like, you know. So I asked her, I complimented her, I said, "Wow, you know, you were really true. You remained true to him while he was gone for 6 years. You didn't go out with any other men, and you were really..."